Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
As you can imagine, it's been a pretty amazing day today already. We appreciate so much all you guys being here. How many of you guys that are here tonight intended to be at the 9 this morning, right? Anybody like that? Like, oh, we just kidding. It's been a great day. We hope that today, as we continue this series, it's exactly what I intend for it to be, an invitation to imagine. I talk to a lot of people, and oftentimes because of my line of work, I talk to a lot of people about God, whether they believe in Him or don't believe in Him, or some particular struggle they have in believing with Him. And what I found is a lot of people were formed or forged this image of God in their minds, largely from their childhood, from something that happened to them, some experience in a church, whether it was good or bad, some experience with some people who were speaking on behalf of God or acting on behalf of God, good or bad, and they formed this picture, this image in their head of who they believed God to be or who they saw God to be. I've had a lot of people tell me about their struggle to believe in God, and I'll ask them, tell me about the God that you're struggling to believe in, and they'll say, oh, God is like this, this, and this. I'll say, well, I don't believe in that God either, because it's not how He is. And so we wind up, and a lot of us, we get into our adult lives, and we have this image that we've never pressed on or tried to decide if it was true or real or correct, or if it is a representation of who God actually is. And I want for you to be able to imagine Him, to like actually let your mind go for a minute and to imagine Him, to see Him with something different. Our whole being speaks this. We know this. Our whole being speaks of wanting to be alive from somewhere deeper than just sort of cognitive understanding or principles about truth or facts or doctrine or whatever it is. We want to feel something deeper. All of our lives speak this. This is why arts exist and music exists and movies exist and all these things exist, because they speak to us at the deepest levels. They know that we long as humans to deal with things here, and it requires some imagination. In fact, when you read the Bible, a lot of us read the Bible, you read it for like stuff to underline, for nuggets, for principles, for truths, for things you can grab and hold on to. But the Bible really is designed, or we read it and it awakens our imagination. All the language speaks to this. In John, when John was opening his gospel, John chapter 1, he says in the beginning, he uses a phrase, he pulls something out of the very beginning of the Old Testament where it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. He pulls this out and he says, in the beginning was the Word. And he begins to paint a picture. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and He was with God in the beginning. He's talking about Jesus, the embodiment of God. In the beginning was the Word, this fullness of all that God would be contained and pressed into flesh and bone and blood. And he pressed him, and in the beginning was this person. And he was with God, and he was God, and he was with him in the beginning, and everything was made through him, and nothing that has been made was made apart from him. This is the imagery that God gives us, that John gives us. In him was the life, and this life was the light of man, and it goes on and on and on. And it's these pictures, it awakens our minds to see things, not to give us facts about how to do things, but to see things, to behold things, to wonder things. In fact, one of the things I've been doing over the last probably 6 months is I've been listening to music more. Listening to worship music more. I've listened to 80s music for the last 30 years, and I realize they've actually come out with new music since then. I didn't realize this. But there's a lot of new music out, and so I've been listening, and I do this very intentionally, because what happens to me is I get busy, and I get pressed, and I get a lot of stress, and I get a lot of pressure, and people pulling on me, and all kinds of things happening. And what I start trying to do is I start trying to organize my schedule tighter. I start to make my life more efficient. I start trying to make sure I can fit all these things in and tick things off my list, and I get a kick out of that. I get a charge out of that. And I realize sometimes I haven't stopped and just really stopped and just tried to look and see. And so music has helped me do that. And over about the last 4 weeks or 3 weeks, I've heard a song or found a song, and the song is by Hillsong. It's a group out of Australia. We do a lot of their music, but the song is called So Will I. And it is absolutely, it's just on repeat. And I listen to it over and over and over and over and over and over again. Sounds a little like that. And I want to read the lyrics to you. I want you to let your mind sort of see some things in the imagery of the lyrics. And this is how it goes. It says, God of creation, there at the start, before the beginning of time, With no point of reference, you spoke to the dark and fleshed out the wonder of light at 186,000 feet per second. At the sound of his voice, let there be light. And as you speak, 100 billion galaxies are born. In the vapor of your breath, the planets form. If the stars were made to worship, so will I. I can see your heart in everything you've made, every burning star, a signal fire of grace. If creation sings your praises, so will I. God of your promise, you don't speak in vain, no syllable empty or void. For once you have spoken, all nature and science follow the sound of your voice. And as you speak, 100 billion creatures catch your breath, evolving in pursuit of what you said. If I see your heart, if it all reveals your nature, so will I. I can see your heart in everything you say, every painted sky, a canvas of your grace. If creation still obeys you, so will I. And it goes on line after line after line after line. Now, what just happened to your mind, right? God of creation, there at the start, no point of reference. These are the things that kindergartners ask their mom and dad. Say, Mom, when did God begin? How did God get here? And we go, well, he's always been here. I go, that doesn't make any sense, right? We start flipping out from the time we're in kindergarten. We can't figure this out. And what happens when we can't figure things out? We start doubting. Well, how can this be? Because we don't let our minds get above what we can see and what we can hear and what we can comprehend. And this is what we've been looking at. This was the impetus of this series was this verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And it says this, that it is written in the Old Covenant. It is written in the Old Testament. And I think we'll put this on the screen. What no eye has seen and what no ear has heard and what no human mind has conceived. Maybe not. See, it was there. What no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and what no human mind has conceived, the things that God has prepared for those who love him. And we looked at this last week and we said, what are the things that God has prepared? You know, when we hear that, what we immediately start to do, and we immediately start to try to imagine what those things are. We immediately start to say, what are the things that God has prepared for me? And what he's saying is, you cannot conceive this. We looked at this and marked this and established this last week. These things that we cannot conceive are the way in which God has revealed himself. If you were not here, you might want to go listen to it last week, how God has displayed himself. We introduce ourselves with a handshake. Hi, my name is Mike. God introduces himself to us, and he splays stars out billions of light years away. He creates oceans, and he creates mountains, and he creates stuff, and he sends his son. He does things to reveal himself that we don't imagine or comprehend. We don't conceive it. The second part is we cannot conceive how he has saved us, how he has brought life to us. We would do it differently, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. And then the third thing that's really important that we our minds is we don't comprehend or we don't see how God has redeemed the life that he has created and intends, the life that he has created for you to live and the life that he intends for you to live. He intends it, and he's redeeming it every single moment of every single day. He's doing all this all the time. It's happening right here, right now. And so we've got to get our eyes, we've got to be able to see this. And what we have to do is to sort of take a step back and consider this from just a little bit different perspective. When God sent his son, if you keep reading in John, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, is how John describes this. In the beginning was the word became flesh and dwelt among us. This is in John chapter 1, verses 14, 15, and 16. It says, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have beheld, we have seen God. We've seen the fullness of God in his son Jesus. And it says two things, that he is full of grace, and he is full of truth. I doubt that people describe you like that. They're like, he's full of it, but not those two things. So he says that God is full of grace, or Jesus is full of grace and full of truth. So I began to get a picture in my head. I use my imagination. I try to contemplate and conceive what it is that my mind can't. And so this is the best I can do. Now, this is just me. If I could, I would have brought a dump truck in here, but I couldn't. So this is going to have to do for our time. But when I think of what God has done, he has given us this vessel. He sent this vessel. Jesus, he is in the flesh. He is all the embodiment of God. He's everything that we need to see in God. And he's right here in this container. And it says that he's full of grace, which I think, because I love the ocean, I think God lives there, that sand represents to me his grace, and truth always feels like a brick. It just feels like solid and it's a brick. And so he's full of grace and he's full of truth. And we have to begin to ask ourselves is, what do we do with this? What do we light from him? When he tells us, what is it he's about? Which one do we gravitate towards? Now, there's a lot of you in here and you're like, love is truth. This is because you think you're right. There's a lot of you in here, you're like, I love his grace. This is because you know you're not right, right? This is how we do things. And so we start to perceive this, and we start to see, which thing do we need from him? Which one do we like from him? And if you're like me, right, I've thought about this because I've been having this conversation. When we think about grace, we don't have a real good picture of what it means or what it is. And I've been asking people this question for the better part of about 2 months. And the question is, what does it look like, or have you ever heard the term perhaps? Let me ask it this way. What does it mean to fall from grace? Right, you've all heard this phrase, right? Fall from grace. Someone falls from grace. What they usually mean is some prominent religious pastor person took a moral dive. Isn't that what it usually means? And that's not this pastor, right? We're not talking about me. We're just so we're clear. But that's the picture we have. Falling from grace means that you did something so bad that even grace can't help you. And so my question isn't, what does it mean to fall from grace? My question is, if you fall from one thing, it implies that you fall towards something else. So when you fall from grace, where do you fall? Do you just go straight to hell? It's like, okay, boom, you've done too much, you're done. Like, what happens to you when you fall? Where do you fall to? Where do you land? Do you realize the Bible actually talks about this, and it talks about it very clearly? Very clearly. This idea that we fall from grace and we disappear off the planet or off God's radar isn't in the Bible anywhere. It says it very clearly. When we fall from grace, we land on its opposite. We land on the other thing that exists. And the other thing that exists is this thing called the law. This is why we say, when you fall from grace, you've done something so bad that even grace can't help you, because that's what the law is about. You see, the Bible's divided in these two places. God divided his revelation into two sections, the old covenant and the new covenant. The old covenant, the old regulation is very simple. If you obey the law, God will bless you. Now, a lot of you guys are like, yes. You love truth. The law also says, if you break the law, God curses you, or there's a curse that happens because you have failed to live up to the law that he's given. So you do good, good things happen. You do bad, bad things happen. That's what we like. Other religions use this. They call it karma. So this is the idea, and a lot of us, if we're honest, this is where we sort of live. We like this because we don't really know what to do with grace, and so we wind up going, I love the truth. And what happens to us when we start to do this, we start to say, I love Jesus. He's full of grace, and he's full of truth, but I'm going to take the truth. And you begin to study it, and you look for nuggets in the Bible, and you get these nuggets. You go, oh, man, there's the truth. And you go, I'm going to go tell my friend how wrong they are. And I'm going to begin to go and make sure they know how right I am. And I'm going to go show them how holy God is. And we're beating the truth drum and beating the truth drum and beating the truth drum. And let me tell you, I love the truth. I love it. I believe in it. I want to understand it. All those things are true for me. What's interesting, the next verse, we looked at this last week. It says that out of the fullness of God, out of all that he is, right, full of grace and truth, we have received grace upon grace, not truth. Now, I've often thought and tried to figure out, is this sort of a play on words? Is this John being fancy, or is there something to this? Because what I want is I want the truth from him. I want to know the truth so I can understand the truth, so I can use the truth to get other people to be true like I am true. And what this is all about is really our attempts to sort of execute this system. That's what happens to us. People ask me oftentimes, they say, Mike, you know, when we're having discussions about who do you see yourself, or when you think about the Bible, who do you see yourself? Which character do you identify with? Maybe it's John, the writer of the Gospel of John. Do you identify with John, or maybe it's, you know, one of the other guys? Maybe it's Matthew, or maybe Paul, because Paul was a preacher. Do you identify with one of those guys? Do you know who I most closely relate to of any characters in the Bible? The Pharisees. I would be a really good Pharisee. I'm a rule follower, right? I get this. I would be a Pharisee among the Pharisees. That's what I would be. I'm pretty convinced I would be telling Jesus all the things that he shouldn't be doing. I would be doing that. And I think maybe it's where some of you are, because I love the law. I love the truth. And it's largely because I don't understand this. Do you know what it says? It says that we have received from his fullness grace upon grace upon grace. I was reflecting on this passage a few years ago, and I wrote this in my journal. I said, God did not entrust us with the truth. He knew better. And what I'm saying is that the truth doesn't matter. What I'm not saying is the truth doesn't matter. The truth matters immensely. What I'm saying is we do not receive the truth from Jesus. We find the truth in Jesus only by receiving his grace. And this is a very different way of thinking, but that's what I want to try to explain to you over the next few minutes that we have together. You see, there's a context for this. For this passage, no eye has seen, no ear has heard. If you look in your Bibles and you open them up, you'll see oftentimes outside of a passage, you'll see like a little letter in there, if you still read on paper. And you'll see a little letter up beside it, and it'll say like there's a little A next to no eye has seen, no ear has heard. And you look down at the bottom, and it'll say Isaiah chapter 64. And then you flip back in your Bible to Isaiah chapter 64, and you read it. And this is what it says. Isaiah chapter 64, verses 3 through 5. It says, for when you did awesome things that we did not expect, right? We didn't see this coming. You came down and the mountains trembled before you. Since ancient times, no one has heard, no ear has perceived, no one has seen any God besides you who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. There it is. You come to the help of those who gladly do right and who remember your ways. I mean, look at this. God comes to the help of those who gladly do right. Well, listen, how many of you guys have ever done right but not gladly? That was like most of my growing up. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to do it. And he comes to the help of those who, our hearts just want to do this. And maybe that's y'all, but sometimes that's not me. He goes on, he says, but when you continue to sin, right, when you continue to blow it, you are angry. God, how then can we be saved? See, a lot of people come into the church, they were probably at the morning services, not y'all, but they come in here, and every week people come in here and they swear they're not going to do what they just did. Every week they swear they're not going to drink anymore, I swear they're not going to smoke this anymore, they're not going to yell at their kids anymore, I swear I'm not going to do this anymore, I swear I'm going to start doing this, and we make all these promises to God every single week. And then usually before they get out of the parking lot, they've already blown it, especially at 11 o'clock, because people can't drive at 11 o'clock, and so they're already yelling at each other. And so it's this idea, we swear, we think of this, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out, what's this balance? What's this balance? How then can we be saved? That's a great question. Because you know what begins to happen? As soon as that question gets on the radar, your imagination starts to run. That starts to work. That's why you think like, if I just do more good things, if I just do this, if I just do that. We begin to sort of establish a system of trying to get truth outside of its full context. Trying to use truth for something it wasn't intended to. If you keep reading, it says this. The next chapter, it goes on. It says, all day long, God says, I've held up my hands to an obstinate people. Do y'all know any obstinate people? You have a friend who's obstinate? Yeah. I'm obstinate. I figured out that this is actually talking to me. To an obstinate people who walk in ways that are not good, pursuing their own imaginations, a people who continually provoke me to my very face. Have you ever made a deal with God that says, if you'll let me do this now, you'll forgive me later, some version of that prayer? God, I know you'll forgive me, so I'm going to go ahead and do this. That's provoking him to his face. It's interesting, it says we fall into prey of using our own imaginations, and here's what happens to us based on the truth. Your own imagination will do two things. It will always do two things. Number one is you will try to justify yourselves. You will try to figure out how you can make the truth such that you were right in doing what you were doing, that what you did really wasn't that big of a deal. You will begin to say, this is why I'm still a good person, even though I did these things. You'll begin to justify yourself, and you will use your imagination to do it. The other thing that you'll do, and this is on the opposite end of the spectrum, is you will use your imagination to disqualify yourself. You will use your imagination to say, I've already done too much. I've already gone too far. God could never reach me again. It's too late. I'm too far gone. I've fallen from grace. And what you begin to see is in Hebrews chapter 6 or chapter 7, it says this. And I think we can get this up on the screen as well. And this was earlier. But it says this. It says, the former regulation is set aside because it was weak and useless, for the law made nothing perfect, and a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God. Do you realize that the reason Jesus came and truth and grace are embodied in him is because it is fundamentally relational? Everything about the Bible is about the relationship that you have with him. In chapter verse 10 of 1 Corinthians, it says, though eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived, the things that God has prepared for those who love him. And it says in the next verse that these things are revealed by the Spirit. These things are revealed to us by God, that we come to see them in the context of our relationship with him. It's always relational. Let me tell you what I mean. What we do is we pull the truth out and we try to use it for our own advantage. And here's what happens. And it happens every single time. My questions are twofold. Number one is, what happens to the truth? When you pull the truth out of its context where it belongs, in Jesus himself, full of grace and full of truth, the truth actually crushes because you can't live underneath it. Those of us who think we're good people, right? And I tell people all the time, I said, Mike, well, I appreciate the church, whatever. I'm a pretty good person. I said, what do you mean? And what they mean is they're better than someone else that they know. That's pretty much what it is. It's some standard that they sort of created. But I ask them questions like this. Well, how's your thought life? You ever been overly angry at someone or contemptuous toward them or just sort of dismissive of them because you believe that they didn't matter because it made you so mad? Have you ever been so angry and thrown something or punched something because Duke got beat by Carolina last Friday night? Right? Any Carolina fans in here, right? Yeah. Have you ever gloated over a victory, right? If you've done any of those things, right, we start to see that we're not, our thoughts aren't quite as pure as the driven snow. Have you ever made yourself look better than you really are? Have you ever allowed a little white lie to go untested because it made you look good? Have you ever not corrected something that someone else, have you ever become complicit in someone else's behavior? Right? What Jesus did when he talked about the law, he would say things like this: if you've ever held contempt for a person in your life, you might as well have murdered them. You've violated the law in that way. If you've looked upon a person with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery with them already. He began to raise the bar, going that nobody obeys the law. And what happens is this pressure of truth just crushes us, and it gets worse. It gets worse. You see, what truth becomes when we take it out of its context, when we misuse it, which a lot of people do, it becomes a tool. It becomes a way for us to determine and discern and use nuggets of truth to make sure that people know that we are right and they are wrong. We use it as weapons in argument. And then worse, it becomes evidence. What do I mean by that? When someone, we take truth, we use it as a tool, we create laws, When someone breaks the law, right? When someone breaks the law, we use the truth as evidence. When you go to a courtroom, you swear in, you say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Why? Because the truth is going to become evidence for the tool. It just gets reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced. And once it gets reduced, it erodes something over here as well. Let me show you what I mean. I had a friend of mine, my niece actually, she was leaving and going out of town last weekend traveling. And she, on her way out, she was going a pretty high rate of speed, and she got pulled over. And she got pulled over for going 75 in a 55. Woo! In case you're doing the math, that is 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. That's reckless driving, I believe, in the state of North Carolina. That's bad news. Insurance goes up. Fines are pretty high. 75 and a 25. Do you know what that is? That is truth. Everybody knows it. She knows it. The police officer knows it. The radar gun shows it. Everybody gets it. It's truth. So he, trying to figure out how to have compassion because he doesn't want her to have to experience or have to pay the extra fees or whatever, he figures out, how can we reduce the charge? How can we reduce the charge? So what he does is he comes back and he gives her a ticket for 69 in a 55, and in case you're doing the math, that is 14 miles per hour over, and that is a lesser and a different charge in the state of North Carolina. And we go, whew, sounds like grace, doesn't it? What happened to the truth? This isn't true. She wasn't going 69 and 55. She was going 75 and a 55. In order to bring the truth to bear apart from what God has done in the law, you have to make it something less. You have to change it. It's why our whole court says, you don't say guilty or not. You don't say guilty or innocence. You say guilty or not guilty. It's always trying to say, I don't want anybody to really know what's going on. We diminish the truth. It always gets diminished. If Jesus is the truth, if that's who he is, and we reduce it, it is blasphemy. And the only way we see it is to see him in his fullness, and out of his fullness, we get grace upon grace. So let's keep going. Let me see if we can kind of wrap this up. Truth is required in order for us to experience grace. Grace always acts as an expander. It acts as an expander. And here's the connection. What Jesus said, or what John says in John 1, is that out of his fullness, we receive grace upon grace. Out of his fullness, and we like this, we receive grace upon grace, but what we have to do is we have to fundamentally, I'm gonna put it up here, receive it. I told y'all when we were doing the series on gods, we are terrible receivers. Every time someone gives us something, we immediately say, well, let me give you something back. Let me do something to even the score. This is why the truth is measured with scales, right? Because justice always equals out truth. What Jesus did is he hid it in his embodiment, and then he said, you're going to get grace upon grace. And he says that those of us who learn to receive grace upon grace will begin to understand how to be changed by the truth. The one thing I've learned, I used to be afraid that if people didn't know the truth, they wouldn't change. If people didn't know the truth, they wouldn't change. And so I spent a lot of time beating people over the head with the truth, trying to convince people of the truth, trying to help people understand the truth. And what I've realized is the only way you change is you receive grace that leads you to the truth. And Jesus does it better than any of us could ever do it. That's how it works. For some of you, the reason you aren't changing, the reason you aren't being transformed is because you have not learned to see this differently. You keep trying to go, here's a nugget, how can I do it? And he says, out of his fullness, we didn't get his truth. Out of his fullness, we receive grace upon grace upon grace. Do you realize that you can't even give if you've never learned to receive? Right? I hear people talk about this. I've heard this. People, you know, especially when it comes to giving money to the churches, right? They go, you know, I know that when God, I've heard people say, you know, trying to help people learn how to give. When you give to the Lord, right, he gives you 100-fold back. And some of you are going, okay, I'm gonna give to the church, write a check to the church, I'm gonna get 100-fold back. That is not giving, that is an exchange. It's an exchange. If we don't learn how to receive, we will never, ever, ever learn how to give. It will always be an exchange. We do this with our kids. We do this with our spouses. If I cook and clean up, I'll be able to go surfing. If you do your homework, you'll be able to do this. If you do this, you'll do that. If you do this, and everything all of a sudden becomes about this exchange. And we never learn how to just give ourselves because we've never learned how to receive the thing that fuels it, and it's grace. The reason I like this is because grace is kind of like sand, right? It goes down and it runs through your fingers. You can get down in it. I mean, how many of you guys have taken your kids to the beach and thought that you got every single grain of sand off of them when you left? And you get back home and what happens? It's in the shower, it's in the kitchen, it's in your car. You know, my worldview is that if you don't have sand in your car, you don't go to the beach enough. And so, but it gets everywhere. Sand sometimes even gets in places you don't want it to get, and it just irritates and irritates and irritates. You know, that's what grace does. If you want to change, if you really want to be changed by who Jesus is and what he does, you start to dig your hands and you start to let him run, you know, let him sift through into the darkest places of your life. That's what it means to receive. The posture of receiving is this, is open-handedness. If we don't do this, everything's going to become an exchange and you'll never find freedom in that. And the connection to me, what's really interesting is when you actually give to another person without expecting anything in return, what you have to do is you have to start to find things that you value. Find things that you love. So when you offer yourself to another person, when you avail yourself, when you give of yourself, you're ascribing value, you're ascribing worth. And guess what it is called when you ascribe worth? It's called worship. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to imagine God. We're trying to get our eyes up because we want to connect in this way. We want to be able to receive from him without doing some kind of exchange and receive. And I found two things to be really true. And this is how I want to close. Number one is when I learn to worship, and I don't mean just sing songs. That's a part of it. But I mean to really get my eyes up, to really get my mind up and my heart to see God as worthy. Whenever we worship, worship can be evidence of truth or evidence of understanding. Worship can be evidence of understanding. And here's what I mean by that, right? Last Sunday night when, or last Friday night when Duke entered into the arena, I came up out of my seat and I stood up. Why? Because I recognize greatness. Right? You see this? So it's evidence that I understand something that maybe other people don't understand. Right? Now, in fairness, I stood last night, okay? I was fired up. It was a great game. I was actually... wasn't rooting for Carolina. I was close. I was feeling for Carolina, right? I was like, but it was a great game. I appreciate greatness. You know, whether you're a Duke fan or Carolina fan or State fan or anything else, you know what everybody does? Everybody goes and takes pictures of the sunset or sunrise because people recognize greatness. It's an act of worship. It's to sit and to go, oh, to go, oh, right? To just let your jaw drop every once in a while. That's what it is. And it demonstrates that we understand things. Now, what's really interesting, and this is why I love science and why I get so frustrated with science. I love science. I love all the nuances, that the more we see, the bigger and bigger and bigger the galaxy is, or the more we sort of microscope down, we look and things get small, we realize there are galaxies inside of our brains and inside of cells that we did not conceive that they were there 20, 40, 50 years ago. And what happens is we reduce to try to understand and go, okay, we understand these things. Now we can explain how they happen. And we don't let our minds awaken our hearts. I did a series years ago about the brain and about mind and mental health and about anxiety and depression. And I began to try to understand why God gave us a brain. Did your parents ever ask you that? Why did God give you a brain? You didn't realize that there's no answer. I looked all over Google. There's no answer. Every system in the body has a reason it exists. Your circulatory system exists to oxygenate your blood. I mean, you go through all these, or to get blood, everyone has a specific purpose. And then when you read what the brain is for, what's the brain for, what's the mind for, it just says it's the executive center of the body. You realize that's no help. What does it execute? It's the executive center. What does it execute? Why does it execute? What is it supposed to do? What's the parameters in which it executes its function? Does it just sort of keep you moving? What does it do? So I've been wondering, why did God give us a brain? Why does God care that we understand planets and solar systems and, you know, quantum physics and micro worlds? I think he wants our jaws to drop and go, oh, I can't believe this. I can't believe it works. I can't believe somebody thought of this. I can't believe this happened like this. I believe that the mind is given to awaken the heart, and we need this to happen. We need to use our minds to cause us, to stir us, to awaken our hearts, to worship. It's what we're made for. Every human is. And the second part of this is that sometimes we need to put our heart on something that our minds can't yet conceive. Some of you have outsmarted yourself. Everything is so systematized and it fits so nicely, and you have forgotten to wake your heart up. And you need to just set your heart on things that are unimaginable. Set your heart on something that you haven't before. Let me tell you how this worked in my life. And it's two songs, one that I just shared with you and one that I grew up with. When I was growing up, and I love my church experience, I'm grateful for it. There's no hostility. I have a great, great, great upbringing, great foundation. But I'm just going to tell you what my mind did. I didn't realize, I actually never would admit this, but this is exactly what happened to me. And I'll never forget this, because we'd sing a song, and you've heard Amazing Grace before. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound, right? You know the song. The last verse says this: when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. Now, as a kid with ADD, I had a picture that happened in my head. Maybe I'm the only one. But the picture of heaven and 10,000 years involved a choir loft and a choir full with people in robes and stoles, and they are singing Amazing Grace over and over again for 10,000 years. I remember thinking, I'm not sure about this. Has anybody ever thought you had that picture? Like, what are we gonna do for like 10,000 years? I can't take Amazing Grace that long. As amazing as it is, right? And if you feel sacrilegious saying that, but that's what I thought. Why? It's my imagination. It's what happened. It just gets there. So that's the picture in my head. I've never challenged it. It just sits there. And all of a sudden, something happens. My heart gets set on something else that provides me with perspective that I did not yet know. The song continues that I mentioned earlier, So Will I. And it goes like this: if the stars were made to worship, so will I. If the mountains bow in reverence, so will I. If the oceans roar, Your praises, so will I. If everything exists to lift you high, so will I. If the wind goes where you want it, so will I. If the rocks cry out in silence, so will I. If the sum of all of our praises still fall shy, I'll sing again 100 billion times. You see what just happened? It all just changed. Now I'm going, I can do that. I needed my heart to catch something to kind of align. It helps us to reform this. And what happens is worship, the sense, engages your heart, engages your mind, and engages your body. The symbol of reception is this. It's open hands. It's letting yourself go. And it's really hard, and it's really easy. And you're going, Mike, what do we do? What do we do? Here's what I would tell you to do, right? Jesus, the embodiment of God here that we get to see, that gave his life for us, that brought us salvation and life, he is full of grace, and he is full of truth. But out of his fullness, we don't get the brick. We get the sand. And what I would say is get a handful of it and begin to let it sift through and begin to sense it and begin to feel it and let it move into your fingers. Maybe what some of you need to do physically is go to the beach and take your hands and put them down in the sand and put your elbows down in there and just let it run through your fingers. Let it get into every single crevice under your fingernails, around every part of you to watch it go in. And then just say, God, I'm touching this and feeling this. And I want to receive your grace in a way such that it saturates and seeps into every dark corner of my heart and my soul, the places where I'm afraid, the places where I'm not sure, the place where I feel like I've blown it, all those places. You want to be changed. You learn how to receive and trust his grace. You want to be formed. You want to be different. You want to be awakened. You want to be alive. You learn how to receive his grace. Out of his fullness, we've received grace upon grace. I'm telling you, when you receive his grace, you will be changed by his truth. But you have got to get your mind, right? We've got to receive this as though he is worthy of our open-handed surrender. Father, my prayer, my hope for all of us, guys, we will be compelled. We've spent so much time trying to figure out a nugget of truth to obey, or something we can do to make sure that we're, God, just let us see you. There's 100 billion ways in which you're on display, and the most magnificent is in your Son, Jesus Christ, who is full of grace, and he is full of truth. God, may we see something that causes us, may we feel something, may we receive something that causes our hearts to leap, that causes our mouths to drop. God, we can receive your grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. Father, that's my hope and that's my prayer. For each person here, we have to go get in the sand at the beach or do something else to help us to see this. God, I ask that you would do that in our lives. Father, I ask this according to your promises in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.